Shalom, shalom, shalom. Baruchim Abaim. Welcome to Awakening Torah Musar Mindfulness. I am Rabbi Chasya Uriel Steinbauer, the founder and director of the Institute for Holiness. We are delighted that you are joining us today on Motzei Shabbat, Saturday, February 17th at 11:04 here in Israel. It is the Gregorian date and time. Right now it is the 8th of Adar, the Hebrew month of Adar Aleph Rishon, in the Hebrew year Tafshin Pei Daled, 5784. We are going to be covering the Torah portion, not from today, earlier, but from last week. And then we will catch up and address today's portion, most likely Bezrat Hashem tomorrow. So we'll be covering Mishpatim. Mishpatim comes as the sixth Torah portion in the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus. And we had met previously this week, earlier this week, for Yitro, where we were introduced to Moshe's father-in-law and how he brought a new judicial system that is going to allow the laws of Mishpatim to be able to flourish, to be able to become a rule of law, as we will see when we move in. So I'm delighted to have you. If you are new, welcome. If you're returning, welcome, no matter what time zone. So if you're joining us over west of us, you are most likely in Shabbat. And if you're observing, you will see us later on. Otherwise, you can watch us live streaming right now on our YouTube channel. Please subscribe. On Facebook, it's live streaming. And of course, we post on LinkedIn and Twitter. And please join our website at kehilatmusar.com. Subscribe to our newsletter there, and you can join us weekly for these public offerings called Awakening Torah Musar Mindfulness. We jump into the weekly Torah portion of the Hebrew Bible to learn from our ancestors and from God how we can apply what's learned there to cope with the genocide of October 7th in Israel, to, for some of us, move towards healing and recovery. For most of us here in Israel, it's a practice in coping. And so this podcast and this video blog is really an honor each week to all the Israelis and to all the Jews throughout the world and our allies who are coping with not only the genocide, the kidnappings and the captives in Gaza, and the ongoing war that's coming from all directions. So we're delighted to have you. We're going to jump in and learn together, and then we're going to engage in mindfulness meditation together to really internalize some stillness, some silence that is so needed right now in order to cultivate and practice. So how do we begin? We are going to cover the Torah portion from February 10th of 2024. The date was the Rosh Chodesh, Aleph of Adar, which this session is in honor and memory of my Abba, which I had talked about before, who actually passed away on 8 years ago on Rosh Chodesh Adar, the new moon of Adar. So this Torah portion takes place on the first of Adar, of Adar Aleph, Adar Rishon, the first Aleph, the first Adar of the year. And it's called Mishpatim. And so if you're following along and want to know where we are in the Hebrew Bible, in the Torah, we are in Exodus and Shemot, chapter 21, verse 1, through chapter 24, verse 18. So we're going to, I'm going to share screen for those of you with vision and are watching the video blog. You have before you three kavanot, three intentions for today's session. For those of you listening by audio or who do not have vision, I'm going to be reading these as we do every week. In order for us to really set today's intentions, what we hope to get out of this session, what we hope to give as part of our practice. So we see this time together as really engaging in an act of radical self-care. We also are doing this so that we can be of service to others, right? To be in relationship with others, and also to strengthen our relationship with God, with the divine. So we say this is doing something to strengthen our own souls, to be of benefit to others in the future, to bring God's good to others, to be a conduit of God's and God's good, so that we may basically be able to be of service to others and give them in the way that they need. So that is our intention, that if we practice, we of course will come more fully into who we are meant to be in service of God and others. And we'll be very clear, we'll be able to see clearly what is our path and how we can just be present for others, offer compassion to ourselves and others. We can volunteer and help others. There's all sorts of ways that this path unfolds over one's lifetime through this practice. So I'm going to stop sharing for those of you watching. And we're going to jump in. I always jump in with a summary of the Torah portion. And then we're going to hone in, really jump in on what I think are the key areas. Okay, so this Torah portion contains many laws. I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's around 51. And it deals with all areas. I took some notes. It deals with, this is just generally, it deals with work, money, property, and courts of law. But just to give you a little bit more detail, we're dealing with male and female slaves, capital offenses, abuse of parents, kidnapping, quarreling, injury that happens in a quarrel with someone else, damage to one's livestock, theft of crops, bailment, goods, the idea of seduction, sorcery, bestiality, apostasy, a concern for the disadvantaged, the most vulnerable in society that we see as the foreigner, the refugee in a sense, the widow, the orphan, and the poor, and duties to God, like judicial integrity, human treatment of the enemy, and agricultural prescriptions and religious calendar. So many things are covered here. And so, for example, what happens when something that belongs to you causes damage to someone else? And what if you accidentally lose or break something that you borrowed from someone else? So this all gets worked out in detail as a beginning in the Torah here. And the Torah emphasizes not to cause distress to what we call gerim. Okay, gerim, a ger is a stranger. And since we're not to cause them distress, because since we too were gerim, we were strangers in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, not too long ago. God in the Torah just took our ancestors, the Hebrews, Bnei Israel, the children of Israel, out of the institution of slavery, out of Egypt. So widows, orphans, and people who are poor also must be treated with rachamim, with compassion. And another principle is to help people even when you don't want to. This gets legislated here. If you see someone who had been your enemy, however you may define that, if they are struggling, you still have to help them. And every seventh year will be what we call Shemitah, the Shemitah year, the year of release. And no one can farm their land during this year. People who are poor may gather and eat whatever grows in the fields. It's like every land is public. And it's because there's a real central concept in the Torah and the Hebrew that the land is really God's. And we're just simply tilling it, taking care of it for God in this process and this time. But in Israel, the children of Israel must celebrate what we call the three pilgrimage festivals, right? So it's Pesach, Passover, Shavuot, the festival of weeks, and Sukkot, the festival of booths. And they're to do this at the Beit Mikdash, the temple in Jerusalem. This will be laid out later, obviously. The Torah finishes describing what happened at Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, where Bnei Israel, our ancestors, received the Torah, and they agree to observe it. And they use very special language, which we will talk about soon, which is Na'aseh v'nishma. We will do and we will listen, in the sense of listen meaning to obey. We will follow, right? And Moshe, our beloved ancestor and prophet here, spends 40 days and 40 nights on top of Har Sinai, on top of the mountain. Okay. So now we're going to jump in with more detail, what we want to focus on here. So Mishpatim really is a book of the covenant, of laws of divine will. And all of these laws, once you start reading through these laws, you have to begin to question and think to yourself, what's the purpose of these laws? What do these laws seek to cultivate? And I posit that these laws are to cultivate a certain type of person, a certain type of soul, a certain type of community, a certain type of rule of law, of living a certain way by rule of law, by a judicial system. Excuse me. So they seek to cultivate a certain type of person. And what kind of person is that? Someone who is attentive, being aware of what's around them. If somebody's fallen, even if we don't like them, something's been stolen, being paying attention to one's life and the neighborhood, and whatever's going around. Attentive, a kind person. A just person, someone who seeks justice, right? Upright, someone who lives by these laws and reflects it, both what we call through emet, which translated as truth, but really is this integrity that you, how you're living on the outside reflects the inside, and how you're living in the inside reflects the outside, your behavior. So upright, compassionate, considerate, these are all. These laws are meant to cultivate the individual this way, the family unit, the community, the tribes, the judges, those who are ruling. This is it, okay? And so we might question, like, okay, this is the project of building the soul of the Jew, of the Hebrew here. And it's really an enforcement of the laws and how we live, right? And part of how we live in these laws, because not everything can go through the judicial system. You're going to notice in these laws a lot of language of if you do this, meaning you shouldn't do this, right? If you do this thing that you shouldn't do, you will surely die, or there will surely be a consequence, something to that effect. And that's because there are certain laws, certain behaviors that can't be put through a court of law that can't be controlled through the court of law, that can't be monitored through a court of law, even enforced through police. Like, people can't know your thoughts and your intention, and when you are, you say, if you hide certain things or not. Okay. So the Jew here that's being built and cultivated through this building of this internal world, what our teacher, Rav Shlomo Walby, may his memory be for a blessing, teaches. That we're building this inner world, right? The Olam Pnimi, that we're really building the promptings of consciousness, right? And that strengthening our inner moral compass that we witnessed in our ancestor Avraham and Sarah and all the way down, right? You heard it during the time of Avraham, and even during the time of the midwives, Shifra and Pua, the language that was used was fear of God. Fear, you meaning fear and reverence, right? Free, fear and awe. The language is Yirat Hashem. Excuse me. And Yirah is a verb. Yod Resh Aleph is, it can't be translated exactly into English. But the concept when Avraham and even the midwives are saying there's no fear of God here, that's essentially the definition of religion in the ancient Near East, right? When someone says there's no fear of God here, they're trying to say Either there's no rule of law, there's no kind of operating internal moral compass that I see people living by right and wrong, right? Their insides are not matching their outside, or their outside's not matching the inside. So we are to cultivate in building here one that's informed by conviction that the source and authority of this path that we're practicing here in Musar mindfulness and was the path for our ancestors, that this is divine, that this law handed down to us is divine, that the source and authority of this path is divine. And that really gives us the convention, conviction to really cultivate this consciousness, this inner moral compass that's going to strengthen the beautiful judicial system that our lovely ancestor, I'm going to include him in it because he's the father-in-law, Yitro, even though he's a Midianite, he comes and helps Moshe establish a new judicial system. That was required before we could get mishpatim, before we could get laws. If we didn't have a judicial system that was carried by other righteous people, they were going to handle multiple cases, 10,000, 10,000s, the thousands, the hundreds, the tens, instead of just Moshe sitting there and ruling everything. That never would have worked. That never would have happened, right? It's essentially having like a dictator that determines everything. And so it took that new judicial system in place for us now to have these mishpatim, these rules, these laws, and that's going to further cultivate and reinforce each other, this inner moral compass that is being tested and strengthened and cultivated through practice and laws. Okay. So I want to say that you can definitely go through and see all these laws here and see how how it's kind of laid out essentially. I want to say one more thing before I get into a detail, which I think is very important, okay? Which is we can now understand why our ancestors, hopefully, Bezrat Hashem, why our ancestors say Naseh v'nishma, right? We will do and we will obey or we will listen. Because that's always been, it's very hard often for the modern Western, more secular student of Judaism, and maybe even practitioner to really kind of swallow that you're supposed to just do and then you will learn, right? That goes against a lot of our understanding in modern society that we're supposed to study and really understand everything first before we commit to doing it. And this is not the case. Judaism is a religion of deed, of doing. You do, and through that doing, through that experiential education and experience, you will learn. You will learn the why of why you do it. And you will learn, yeah, I am listening, I am obeying because I'm doing and I've learned. So it makes total sense that Yitro comes, helps develop this amazing judicial system. These laws come in, and we are really reinforcing and understanding that our ancestors and even us today believe the source to be divine. And that source by nature, because it's divine, is obviously pure and right and upright and truth, the very kind of definition of emet, of truth, then of course we will follow, we will do whatever is stated. Okay, that's the understanding that needs to be internalized as a practitioner, really, that there is something so divine and holy and pure that we know is the source, that we can trust. And therefore, there's no more, you don't have to question, is this the right thing? It doesn't mean you shouldn't be a questioning practitioner, a questioning person, but there's just a certain trust in the world, right? This concept that comes through the Dharma of karma in the sense of there is a system of cause and effect. There are consequences for our behavior. It's built into the very fabric of the universe. That's how Hashem made it. We can trust that deep in our bones, right? We can let go that we think we can and should control everything because we can't. We just put one foot in front of the other. We do the right deeds, right? One day at a time. So we are to elevate, spiritualize, really, hallow in a sense, who we are and how we behave daily. That's so clear in these laws. If we were going to put these today, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, these laws don't really have anything to do with me. I don't have any slaves. I'm not doing anything. But let's put it in today's language. You might not have male and female slaves, but you have children. And lots of people think that they own their children. We don't believe that in Judaism. We really see them as gods, right? They're in some ways they're on loan to us. But here we have children, right? And how are we to take care of them? What's our responsibility? What, God forbid, you know, there's a family that causes harm to their children, or the children cause harm to the parents or the grandparents. How are you going to deal with that in a judicial system? We still have capital offenses. We still have abusive parents. We still have kidnappings, God forbid. We know this very intimately. We have quarreling that goes on between neighbors and even non-neighbors, and obviously nation state to nation state, or terror group against nation state. We have injury. So we might not have livestock today. Some people still do, obviously, but we have other things. We have domesticated animals, cats, dogs, birds, whatever people might own. There's theft that still goes on. We might not have damage to our crops, but we could have damage to our yard or our house or our car or our bike or anything of that. There's still bailment, there's still goods. We don't really talk so much about seduction today, but we have definitely rape and sorcery. I don't even want to touch bestiality. Obviously, that still exists. That would be dealt with in a system. The key things, right? These duties to God, we still have them. These are the mitzvot that we do, the commandments to serve God. It's a form of avodah, of service, right? We still want, and we still have judicial integrity. There's still humane treatment of the enemy. There's still, you know, agricultural prescriptions that we here in Israel live by. We still live by the religious calendar. So these laws are really split up between how are we to act and how are we not to act, right? And this is so like without this path, without these laws, and without this path of Musar mindfulness, right? We come on a daily basis to defile, causing harm and suffering to others. And it negatively affects our own soul, our relationship with others, and definitely our relationship with God. And so this is the consequence. This is the thing I talked about with the karma. Excuse me, I might sneeze. Excuse me. Okay. So this really law of cause and effect is still with us, and we can learn this from the gift of our ancestors and God of these laws here. So I want to touch upon the concern for the disadvantage, particularly the ger, right? What we call the stranger, what we might call the immigrant, the migrant, the refugee, that which is not, doesn't have the privileges of citizenship and belonging, maybe even if they do have citizenship, so that might fall under certain immigrants, where there's really a sense of that they are treated unfortunately differently and sometimes poorly, right? So the key thing I want to bring up, which is so incredible that our ancestors have passed on to us, is they looked really deeply, right? The Mefasharim, the Parshanim, the commentators, our rabbis over time really looked at, just because we were a ger in Egypt, right? Just because we personally experienced that humiliation, that degradation, that does not guarantee that we will not act poorly to the new ger in front of us, Right? There's no guarantee that the experience of the past will act as a deterrent for our behavior. That's very profound for our ancestors and God to come and say, I'm going to teach you about the ger, the foreigner, the outsider. I'm going to teach you that you are to practice cultivating your whole life as part of your spiritual discipline as a Jew, to remember that you were a ger and to remember that experience of degradation, humiliation, so that hopefully over time you will internalize that to a point that you will never act out to how you were treated, to how you were humiliated and degraded, that you will never do that to that whoever the new ger has to be happens to be in society at the time. And so by even acknowledging that, right, and saying that we have to be reminded by God and our ancestors that we were giving in Egypt and that we're to recall that every time that we are to have concern for the disadvantage of society, those who are really treated the worst. And while we're recalling why we are have such great concern for them, which always means deed. It doesn't mean just like, oh, I have concern in my heart for them. No, for us, we have to then act out in deed. We have to care for them. We have to provide for them. when we do that act and deed, we have to recall that we were Gerim in Egypt. And we do that as a practice to internalize and cultivate because we know that that memory and the recollection of it just one time, maybe daily, maybe even over years for some of us, and maybe even collectively, some of us, there's no guarantee that that recollection of that past experience is going to act as a deterrent from our selfish behavior, behavior that every human being has, behavior that we might have ill will towards someone, that we might have delusion, that we might have fear that we act out. We might have greed, right? That we want to hold on to what is ours. This is all in the spectrum of being a human being that our ancestors and God recognize is that you're going to encounter this. As the Hebrews, as B'nai Israel, as the Jewish people, you're going to encounter all these hindrances and obstacles that will come up. And I'm here to remind you that when that greed, hatred, and delusion arises, you're still supposed to try to recall that you were Gerim in Egypt, and you're still supposed to try to treat those who are especially vulnerable, right, to exploitation. These people have God's special concern. This is God's special project. It's very important. It's the stranger, the widow, the orphan, the poor. This its sensitivity is not simply only out of humanitarian concern. It's a divine imperative. This should be a wake-up call. Because we all think intellectually and emotionally, of course I would never discriminate against the stranger and the widow and the orphan and the poor. That's horrible. Of course, we would take care of them. My heart's open to them. I have compassion for them. And it's like, really? I hear you. And what are you actually doing? What are you actually doing for them? Some of you might be giving tzedakah, charity, money. That's a start. That's obligatory for us. But what are you actually doing? What are you doing to take care of them? What are you doing to make the situation structurally better and different? Right? So this is a divine imperative. So not only is if we act out in our selfish ways, which we're human, some of us are going to sin and do this, it is considered the cause and effect is that it's sinful in our tradition. It's a violation of God's commandments, right? Of God's will. And all these laws are both addressed both in the singular and plural in order to really get at us and penetrate. I'm like, it's like God saying, I'm talking to you, talking to you directly. I'm talking to your people. I'm talking to everyone here. And it's beautiful, right? It recognizes that both us as individuals and society are equally responsible and accountable for this covenant with God. Okay. So I can't even tell you how important this imperative is that we are not to cause harm and suffering to the gear. It's repeated over and over and over again. I can't remember the number. Somebody here is going to know. It's like 70 something. It is such a part of our tradition. We recite it morning and night in our Shema, and what I would say in Judaism's most central important prayer. We're constantly recalling it in the three times a day in the morning, afternoon, and evening prayers, and what's called the Amidah, the standing silent prayer to God. So we have a daily practice of recalling that we were strangers, not only strangers, but slaves in Egypt. And then, of course, we have, like, in case you didn't get the daily message, we also recall it before the Shabbat and during Shabbat, during Kiddush. We always remember God, the Yitzhak Mitzrayim, taking us out of Egypt, right? And then, of course, we're going to have the annual master weekly practice and tradition of recalling that we were slaves in Gerim in Egypt during Passover, during Pesach. So it's built in that we are to cultivate this, right? I would just say the final thing I would that our compassion, our empathetic regard for the disadvantage of society, particularly the ger, but all the categories, widow, orphan, and poor, should be its part and stimulated by our own historical experience. Okay. And that God's concern is out of God's this concept that we see God's essential nature as intolerant of injustice and compassionate for those that are most disadvantaged. And we work to practice that in our daily Musar mindfulness practice to internalize that we are to be agents of God, and therefore we are going to have to find it intolerant, the injustice, and that we are to be compassionate for the most disadvantaged. Okay. So I love that our ancestors really took the time to know that and to admit to us. Think about having such an ancient tradition. You know, obviously, like coming 4,000 years ago and then really recorded 2,500 years ago, to be able to learn from an ancient tradition of Judaism that comes to say that even though you're going to know your history and that you have this memory of degradation and humiliation, it's unfortunately not going to be a guarantee that it's going to be a deterrent. It's going to act as an actual spiritual discipline, a practice, as a deterrent from you treating someone else that way. That's pretty profound. Okay. When you finally have your ancestors and God saying this to you, admitting this to you, that even though we know this, we're still going to have the daily practice to recall how it felt to be strangers in another land, that we are bidden to do that as a daily spiritual practice. And that we always have to keep a watch out for ourselves. It's there as a gift to teach us that, okay, I have this daily spiritual practice for you. I'm going to, help you remember. It might not work as a deterrent. I'm going to try to strengthen you through community and taking refuge in this practice and path, that you're going to have to keep it mindful, that you're going to have to become sensitive and aware that if you do have greed, ill will, and delusion arising towards the stranger in front of you, that there's a sign that the deterrent of you having the memory of that experience is it didn't work for you in this moment. Doesn't mean it's a failed project. We still practice it. We still do it. But just how beautiful and humbling to be able to have our ancestors come and say, listen, we've laid out this path for you, and it's not a guarantee. It's going to be a deterrent for the worst sides of you and humanity that can exist, the selfishness that can come out, the greed, right? And that's okay. That's more than okay. It's beautiful that we've been safeguarded as this. Our ancestors have been the gatekeepers for us. They're saying, hey, here's our tradition. Here's our inherited history, this amazing transgenerational resilience and trauma all together in this pie that we're giving you with this daily Musar mindfulness practice. You're going to practice it. You're going to pray. You're going to recall the exodus from Egypt and being strangers. It might not work for you individually, and maybe even as a society or group. And so we're going to put one foot in front of the other, to do our best, essentially. Okay. And there's something just for me that was really, I mean, this is the stuff that why we practice, why we turn to our amazing traditions, right? To really know that our tradition isn't coming to us to say, you're going to be perfect, you're perfect, you should just do these practices or this law or give this offering and then you'll be fine. It doesn't say that at all. It is so beautiful. It's just really upfront and honest that this is it. This is what you're going to encounter. We try to give you this path and practice to be this deterrent from your worst side, what we call the Yetzer Hara. It translates as evil inclination, but I really see it more as this like what's the word I'm looking for? Not even energy. The inclination to be selfish, the inclination to cause harm and suffering to others, the inclination to act out our hindrances, our doubts, our fears, our greed, our ill will, our delusion, right? That we all have this within, and we safeguard ourselves from the inherited path and tradition of our ancestors. And we act as our own gatekeepers. We try to become aware if we're behaving or acting out in a certain way, especially when we have the most disadvantaged in front of us. And that they should be in front of us. They should be in front of us. We should constantly, daily be thinking of them and thinking, how can I be of service to them? How can I help them? How can I be a part of society and initiative in order to address their needs? B'ezrat Hashem, God willing. So I will close and move into our practice together with it's not a mistake, or it's not even a coincidence that our ancestors and God come at the end of this Torah portion with the laws of the Chagim, of the festivals and Shabbat, in order to say, this path that I have before you, these laws, these commandments are tough. Are going to be tough. They're raising you to a level towards holiness. It's going to be an ongoing daily practice that you have to take refuge in community and each other. And you're going to need what we call menuchat hanefesh, that calmness and centeredness of soul practice, what is called equanimity in English. You're going to need that practice that the Chagim, the festivals, and Shabbat ideally should provide if you're practicing them correctly. You take this ceasing. Shabbat Shin Bet Tav means to cease. Everyone thinks it means to rest. Ceasing is a form of resting, but it's a ceasing from everything that you do the other 6 days of the week. Same thing in the festivals. You're going to cease and you're going to come into stillness. Going to recover. You're going to practice radical self-care so that you can bring God's good to others after Shabbat, after the Chagim, after the festivals.
Really, it stabilizes us. It strengthens our moral inner compass to be able to reinforce that rule of law in the judicial system. It's a transformational practice that we get as a gift that you're all welcome to take on and keep with us. It's a gift once a week. And then the Hagim, the festivals when they come, wow. I live it. I can give you testimony. Can't imagine my life without them. I really love them. I'm restored by them. So let's practice now our own little Shabbat, our own little hug. We're going to move into whatever posture is needed to sit together. I say sit metaphorically because I sit during my meditation practice, but you don't need to. You can stand in a kind of strong mountain pose. You can walk back and forth, going nowhere. It's called walking meditation. You can lie down. Just keep your eyes open if you have vision so you don't fall asleep. If you're seated like me, just come to the edge of the seat and sit dignified because you are created in the image and likeness of the divine. You should be dignified, right? So come to that dignified position. Not West Point stiff, as our teacher Jon Kabat-Zinn loves to remind us. You're at ease also. We're going to begin with a deep inhalation as a cleansing breath to begin to arrive here. You may close your eyes if you feel safe and comfortable. Otherwise, just lower your gaze down like this. And inhalation, here we go. And exhale. Inhalation. Exhalation. This time, raise your shoulders up to your ears and drop them on the exhalation. Oh, it feels so good, yeah? Let your breath fall to its own natural rhythm. You can leave a smile on your face if you have it. Just come to your own quiet space, inviting that stillness, inviting the quiet. Letting your hands rest on your lap before you or wherever is comfortable. If you have any history of trauma, please really ground your feet, making sure you feel stable and here. Feel free to open your eyes at any point if you feel unsafe, knowing that you are here with me. And the practice is to be here in the present moment. And again, and again. Bringing your loving attention to your thoughts. Just noticing if you're having a lot of them and if they're bouncing all around, what we call monkey minds. Or maybe there's just a quiet stillness there. Just noticing without judgment. This is us training our brain, training ourselves to be able to bear witness without reactivity, to just watch what's going on without identifying and without pushing it away. Whatever arises. And bringing your loving attention to the sensations in your body. How is your body right now? Feeling a lot of energy any place? Maybe stiffness or soreness. Feel the oxygen as your deep breathing flows all the way down to your toes, filling your lungs and your stomach. Feel the life force flowing through you. Bringing your loving attention to the emotions within. How's your mood? What is the state right now? We're going to invite mindfulness of thought in our general mindfulness meditation today. As you follow the sensations of your breathing or the sensations of your body, There will be a stream of thoughts in the background. Just let them be. Let them rise and fall like the waves of the ocean around the breath. Some of you may have trouble noticing the thoughts. Some of you may be surprised at how many there are. Just come with the curiosity of a child, what we call that beginner's mind, just noticing. Periodically, whether after 3 breaths or 6 breaths or 10 breaths, a strong thought will arise and it'll carry the attention away. As soon as you notice this thought that wants to carry you away, name it gently, quietly to yourself, according to its predominant quality. You can use simple notes like planning, remembering, judging, worrying, imagining, or fearful thought, happy thought, interesting thought, creative thought, painful thought, and so forth. Simply naming and acknowledging the thought is supportive of the witnessing quality of mindful, loving awareness. Once you have noted a thought gently for some time, you will notice that it dissolves like a cloud under sunlight. Thoughts are ephemeral. They are empty. They have no substance except what we invest in them. After the thought has diminished, simply return again to mindfulness of breath and body for a time until another strong experience, whether a thought or emotion or sound, pulls your attention from the breath. Stepping out of the stories the thought tells, you can see the common patterns of thought without being so caught in them. And more importantly, you begin to rest in the field of mindful awareness rather than repeatedly carried away by thought. Think about how often we move into narrative. Into storytelling about what's going on, about what has happened. Now you can alternate mindfulness of breathing with mindfulness of other strong experiences as they arise. Developing and cultivating the steady, loving witness that arises and passes. We can be that steady life force, sitting, cultivating amidst the rising and falling of waves of this experience, of this ongoing war. We will watch how we allow narrative and storytelling to emerge, noticing that it is a thought, and we can allow it to pass with time. Bring your loving attention to how it feels the very moment you shift from being absorbed or lost in thought to simply naming it without being swept up in it. I think of our beloved Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, back in Yitro, that when his lovely father-in-law came to him and said, "What you're doing is not healthy and good for you. You cannot continue like this." He could have very well moved into really strong reactivity. If he had too much anava, too much humility of, in the form of low self-esteem in that moment, he could have moved into storytelling, a narrative that, oh, my father-in-law thinks I'm awful, that I'm not enough, that I'm not doing a good job. Look at this. He's just criticizing me. He came here all the way from Midian to criticize me. But he didn't do that, did he? Paused. He reflected, and he did, and he listened and obeyed. He did the, we will do, and we will listen. Very profound. Notice the thoughts that you are having and the effect on the body. What thoughts trigger what in the body? What is the bodily effect? Maybe for Moses in that moment, Moshe Rabbeinu, maybe he felt a deep release, the ability to breathe for the first time, such weight off his shoulders. He must have felt a real bodily effect from that suggestion to build a different judicial system. Notice how some thoughts automatically bring strong emotions and how some emotions bring up certain thoughts. We are cultivating the ability to bear witness the interplay between thought and emotion. Notice the experience of space between thoughts. In your practice this week, deliberately bring up a sad or an angry or a loving thought, and notice how powerfully these thoughts and their connected emotions affect the whole state of body and mind. And as we move into our last minute of silent meditation, where I will ring the bells when we are done, I want you to imagine you are the open sky and thoughts float through like clouds. Sense what it's like to shift from thinking to just lovingly noticing the clouds. If you had your eyes closed, gently and slowly open them, allowing the light to trickle on in slowly. Give God a deep bow of gratitude to this day and practice that we have one more day together. Give yourself a deep bow to yourself and your practice, to your teachers and ancestors, to this path of looser mindfulness that we're able to take refuge in together. Please subscribe to us at our newsletter and join our community at the Institute for Holiness, Kihilat Musar Mindfulness. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and join us for this weekly public offering where we really delve into Torah, the weekly Torah portion. We will be joining the Zrat Hashem, God willing, for our next Torah portion, which we read today. If you are part of a minyan or synagogue community, we read Tuma, which is a wonderful Torah portion where we start to build the Mishkan, the tabernacle that will go up in the Midbar in the wilderness. So we will meet to cover that one and practice. Yes, please be in touch with anyone you want to honor. Or in memory of anyone. And let's continue to practice and strengthen each other on this path and to deal with coping and healing and recovery since October 7th. Thank you so much. Again, I'm Rabbi Chasio Uriel Steinbauer, the founder and director of the Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness. Take care.